Little Aaron Copeland to get us going on our next part of our program. And I think it's appropriate because it brings to mind the outdoors and walking and hiking and looking, I guess. And there's a guy, Kerry Siegel, who did a lot of walking. In fact, he walked the whole Appalachian Trail, and he wrote a book about it. It's called A Talk in the Woods, Voices Along the Appalachian Trail. It's a great read, and I'm glad to have him with us today in the studio to talk about the book and to talk about the people that he met along the trail. And maybe you've thought about the Appalachian Trail and maybe hiking it, or maybe you already have done a part or all of the Appalachian Trail and you want to join in with your own thoughts and comments. Maybe you just have a question about the trail. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Kerry Siegel, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks a lot for having me on the show, Larry.
And I should have mentioned, Kerry's a former reporter and copy editor at the Wisconsin State Journal, and has done many other things as well. The book itself, published by Black Burner Books, and the Appalachian Trail, Kerry, it's almost 2,200 miles long. It passes through 14 states, I think Georgia to Maine. How did you decide to hike the trail?
Well, back when I was a student at the UW in my early 20s, I took my first backpacking trip with Hoofers. Yeah. And I knew then I'd probably want to hike the whole thing someday. And over the course of many years after that, I'd hiked several sections of it in several states. And finally, when I took a buyout from the State Journal, I decided that was a good time to do the whole thing.
And you were 64 years old when you started in late May of 2014, if I'm not mistaken. How did you know you could do it?
Well, I've been running since I was in high school, ran cross country, and I was in good shape, and I'd been running 50 to 60 miles a week, and I'd hiked sections of it, so I was fairly sure I was in good enough shape to do it at that time.
You started in 2014, didn't quite make it that year, but...
Well, what happened is most people start the trail in March or April, and take about 6 months to get to Katahdin in Maine, and I didn't start till late May because I'd run the 20-mile Sydney My Race from Madison to Stoughton. At that time, I'd done it 36 years in a row, and I didn't want to break my streak.
Okay, well, I can understand that. Well, you know, you spent all those years writing and reporting and editing for the State Journal, but you didn't expect to write about hiking the trail. Is that right?
No, I'd read many books about the trail before I started, many memoirs. And they're all quite similar, most of them, except for Walk in the Woods by Bill Bryson. And people write about their hike and what they eat and how far they walk and their experiences. And I didn't really think I'd have much to add. But then I started hiking it, and the first day I met a pretty interesting character. And after a couple of days when I met more, being a reporter at heart, I decided I wanted to write about the people that I met. So I started talking to pretty much everybody I met, and if they had an interesting story, I'd ask them if I could interview them, and I'd say I was a former reporter writing a book about the trail. So I mainly wrote about people, but actually a few hundred people that I met on the trail, and a little bit about me and my hike to carry the story along, to tie the stories together.
Yeah, it was. And how many did you interview? A couple hundred people? I mean, the names in the book, there's a lot of names.
Well, I've never counted them all, but I know it's more than 300 people.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I wonder, did that slow down your hike?
Yeah, that's why I started what I planned to be a through hike. And that's when you start actually, the definition of a thru hike is doing the whole trail within 1 year. But most people do it, start in Georgia and hike to Maine, and it takes about 6 months on the average. And I had about 5 months, but I was in good shape, so I thought I could do it. But then I started talking, interviewing people. And then after about a week, I decided I better start writing stories or I would never do it. So I stopped in a small town in North Carolina, Franklin, North Carolina, and took the day off and went to the library and wrote my first story. And then I emailed it to everybody on my email list because I figured that would get me feedback and incentive to keep going. And once I started doing it, people would ask me questions. I'd keep doing it. So I continued stopping every once in a while to write stories. And after about 1,000 miles at the North End of Shenandoah National Park, I realized I couldn't keep stopping or I'd never finish the trip.
Well, one of the people, I want to talk about some of the hikers you met on the trail because there's some fascinating people. And let's start with Warren Doyle, who wrote a really nice foreword to your book. And you call him a trail icon and a iconoclast. Why?
Well, Warren is a legend on the trail, and he's got a controversial personality, and he's really opinionated about what he believes about the trail. And he hiked it the first time when he was in college in Connecticut, and he hiked it in what was then the record time of 66 and a third day. And he became obsessed with the trail. And then he started leading groups of students on the trail. And the trail essentially became his life, although he has been a professor also. But he's hiked it 18 times, 9 times with through hikes and 9 times with section hikes. And I met him. I knew about him because there's been a lot written about Warren Doyle. Everybody anybody that knows much about the trail knows about Warren Doyle. And I was in Vermont staying at a hostel for the night, and there were 3 women there who told me that they were on one of Warren Doyle's guided hikes. What he did was he trained groups of people how to hike the trail and on a strict schedule with day packs. And he had a van in which he carried the gear of the people that they all had a bin. Uh-huh. And so I interviewed these 3 women at the hostel about what they knew about the hike, and then I met Warren the next morning. And so I talked to him a little bit on the trail. And then I wrote about the 3 women, and I wrote about him. And he was leading this hike with everybody donated for expenses for the hike. And they all had day packs, and they had a strict schedule of where they're going to be each day and each night. And in the morning, they all put their what they didn't need in the bins in the van. And he also had his car there. And he'd drive the van north to the endpoint, and then he'd hike south back to his car while everybody else was hiking north. And then he'd drive his car to the northernmost point, and that's what they did. And everything was on a strict schedule, and he did, well, I don't remember exactly how many times he did this, but when I met him, it was in 2015, and he's my age.
Yeah.
So he did one more when he was 67. And but he also has what's called the Appalachian Trail Institute in northeastern Tennessee. And he gives courses on how to thru-hike the trail. So people go to his place, and he has 5-day courses on how to hike thru-hike the trail. And he also still leads maybe month-long hikes, doing the same way that he calls them smart hikes. And he runs the institute out of a 19-room farmhouse he owns, and he also has the Appalachian Folk School in the same place. So Warren Doyle is a legend on the trail, and it's become his life.
Well, and he described you as curious and caring, competent newspaper reporter who unselfishly gave up his original goal of a through hike to cover the human side of this pilgrimage route. That must have made you feel good to see what he wrote.
And I was appreciated the fact that he even wrote a foreword.
Yeah.
He read the book, and he apparently liked it because he agreed to write the foreword. And and then actually in May, there's a big celebration in Damascus, Virginia called Trail Days. It draws many thousands of people to the trail every May, and he invited me to come there this May, where I gave my first little talk about the book. And he's in charge of presentations at Trail Days.
We probably don't, or maybe we do know, I doubt it, though, how many people have actually walked that trail?
If I knew you wanted that statistic, I would have looked it up. But I know today about a few thousand people start a thru hike each year. Some start in the south in Georgia. A much smaller percentage start in Maine. And some people start in the middle and then go north and then go south. People do it a variety of ways, but most start in Georgia. And about 3,000 this year, about 25% about 25% quit after the first 31 miles. Some quit. There's an approach trail to the Appalachian Trail from a state park in Georgia called Amicalola Falls, which is about 8.8 miles. And some people quit on the approach trail. And including a girlfriend I had in my early 20s, a former girlfriend in my early 20s. But about half of the people that start make it to Harper's Ferry, which is at 1,019 miles, kind of which is where the headquarters of the Appalachian Trail Conservancy is, which manages the trail for the National Park Service. And about half of those make it to Katahdin. So about 25% of the people that start a thru hike actually finish it. People that have been trained by Warren, about 3/4 of those actually finish the thru hike. And people that have gone on his guided hikes, I think all but one have finished the hike. So, but it's most people quit for one reason or another, injuries or boredom, or they just get sick of it, or they get sick. But so.
And there's we can get into the way that people walk, because there can be stops along the way, and I want to get to that. But one of your favorite stories, and kind of one of my favorite stories too in the book, had to do with what everybody has a handle, and the mama bear and the cubs. To me. I think it was Lisa Murray was from Florida, and her twin children, Tess and Cole, 3 years old when they started their hike.
Yeah, they were 2 weeks short of their fourth birthday when they started in May. And I had heard about them at about 400 miles. I was about 400 miles into my hike. And I heard that they were ahead of me. And being a newspaper reporter, I thought it would be a great daily newspaper story, not just for the trail. So I tried to catch them. And I caught them about 8 or 9 days later. And they were staying at a hostel in Virginia. And a couple women who knew them showed me where they were camped for the night. And I went and talked to her and told her I was a former reporter and I'd like to write about them. And I asked her if I could hike with them for a day and a half, because I thought they were a great story. And she said that would be fine. So the next morning, I met her and the twins, and I hiked with them, and I saw, because I wanted to see how they did it. And her story is she had these twins when she was living in Naples, Florida, and she was a teacher at the time, but she decided to clean houses because she wanted to raise the twins. She also had two other children. She had, at the time, a 10-year-old from a different father and a 20-year-old from a different father. And she'd take the twins on a stroller along the beach in Naples, which is about 10 miles long. And when they got too heavy to take them to push them in the stroller, she'd take them hiking on the beach. And she'd read a documentary about, or seen a National Geographic documentary about the trail 6 years before, and she'd always thought that's what she wanted to do someday. And these twins were hiking 6 miles, and then they were hiking 10 miles. And then she had them hike in the soft sand instead of the hard sand, and they could do that. So then she started thinking maybe it was possible to take them on the trail. So she called the Appalachian Trail Conservancy in Harpers Ferry, Virginia, to get the names of other parents that had taken kids on the trail. And none had done it with kids that were 3 when they started. They're mainly in their maybe 8 to 10. And everybody told her not to do it, except one guy who lived in Delray Beach, Florida, who had thru-hiked it with his 10-year-old, and he told her she might as well try it. She had nothing to lose, and if she had to turn back, she had to turn back. And she wanted to convince her second husband, at least the father of her 10-year-old, let him go on the trail, and he said, no way. And she convinced him to take the 10-year-old. And so the 20-year-old drove the three of them to the start in Georgia. And he hiked with the three younger children and their two Chihuahua mutts the first 31 miles to where people tend to quit. And then he went back and got the car and picked up the dogs. And she hiked with the three children, the 3-year-olds when they started and the 10-year-old, as far as Damascus, Virginia, which is 467 miles. And then the 10-year-old had to leave with his father to go to a sailing camp. She continued hiking with the kids who had turned 4 on the trail. And what she told me is when she started, at the start, there were most of the people that hiked the trail are recent college graduates. And she said, at the end of every day, she was keeping up with the college kids, and they were kind of amazed that she was doing 10 to 15 miles a day. And but eventually, the college kids got the trail legs, and they took off. But she kept going. And when I met her, she was at about 621 miles. And she realized that she wasn't going to make it to the end in Maine. But she thought she'd head to Harper's Ferry. So the day and a half I hiked with her, these twins, they basically scampered right along the trail over the rocks and over the roots, and they were pretty amazing, and they were enjoying it. They had fun. And then the next day, we got to Paris for Virginia, and I took them out for lunch, and then I stopped in a hotel room. I wanted to write their story. And she went out and packed her pack with food for the next several days. And came back to my motel room, and I tried to lift her pack, and I thought it weighed about 60 to 70 pounds. And my pack weighed 20 to 30 at that time, and I had a fairly light pack. And then she took off, and I saw her a couple other times, because I'd catch her and talk to her for a while. And then she got to Waynesboro, Virginia, where there's a river that you can take to Harper's Ferry, the Shenandoah River, instead of the trail. And she decided to do that to give the kids a different experience. And she'd never canoed before. And there were some rapids where she got dumped in the trail, in the river at one point. But she made it to Harper's Ferry. And then the next year, she went back to Harper's Ferry with the kids who are now 5 and the 10-year-old who is now 11. And she made it the rest of the way to Katahdin. And when she got there, the twins were 5, and the rules at Baxter State Park, where Katahdin is, which is a very steep mountain to climb and very difficult, is that you have to be at least 6 to attempt this climb. And she told the rangers that she'd come this far and she was not going to not climb Katahdin. So they gave her a special permit, and she made it the first. The Katahdin is a very steep mountain, and yeah. It's about 5 miles. And after the first 3 miles, you get to a boulder field that's about 3/4 mile long and very difficult. And she got there, and it was very windy, and the twins started crying, so she turned back. And she got back to the bottom, and the rangers, who were friendlier now, they told her about another. There's a number of trails that go up Katahdin.
Oh.
And they told her about a trail that was a little easier, so she...
She took it.
She took it, and she made it to the top. And then she went back the next year to Damascus and hiked the trail from Damascus to Harper's Ferry so that they could do the whole trail and the 10-year crew the whole trail. So,
our guest today, Kerry Siegel, his book is titled A Talk in the Woods, Voices Along the Appalachian Trail. Questions for him, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about the book, A Talk in the Woods, Voices Along the Appalachian Trail, with its author, Kerry Siegel. Great to have him with us. The Appalachian Trail Conservancy estimates that 3 million visitors hike a portion of the trail every year. Most enjoy day hikes and short backpacking trips, but each year a small fraction of those hikers complete the entire trail. How many? Well, since 1936, more than 20,000 hike completions have been recorded by the Appalachian Trail Conservancy, and this includes through hikes and multi-year section hikes. Questions, again, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Ann in St. Germain. Hi, Ann. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. I just wanted to call because we recently completed a through hike in early September, and we through hiked with our 10-year-old son as a family and had a fantastic experience. And just wanted to say what a valuable asset the trail is. You know, there's so much you can learn when you're on the trail, you know, from history and geography and, you know, meeting the different people of the different regions and the hikers that are hiking along with you. We hiked northbound this time from Georgia to Maine, and 22 years ago, my husband and I hiked it southbound. And we chose to go northbound this time because you know, with our 10-year-old son, he's pretty social, and we liked the idea of having more companionship on the trail, which we found as we got further north, it ended up being mostly just the three of us most of the day. So it was just in the early part of the trail when a lot of people are starting out. We had a lot of other hikers that we would pass on a daily basis. But really, once you get up there, further north and, you know, further into the hike, it becomes a little bit more of a quiet walk in the woods.
Oh, well, Ann, thanks so much. Comment on that, Carrie?
Well, I think it's great that she did it with a 10-year-old. There aren't that many people with young kids on the trail, but there are others with 10 and in their early teens and single digits. So I think that's great that you did it. And I know she said she did it southbound the first time, which is a very difficult way to do it, depending on when you start. But people start in Maine, going south through Maine in June usually, when it's very wet and very buggy. And so that's doing that was pretty admirable. It's a tough thing to do.
Yeah, Anne, thanks so much. It sounds like you had a wonderful experience, and thank you for calling. Joel, who's on I-90 heading south. Joel, what's on your mind?
Good day, gentlemen.
Hi.
Just a quick question. Obviously, the foundation of everything for what you're doing is your feet, because your feet, well, your whole body carries you the whole way, but your feet hit the rubber. What kind of preparation do you do for your, you know, your footwear? Obviously, you probably maybe go through more than one or two or three. I mean, obviously, the footwear has got to take a beating because your feet are so important.
Yeah.
What can you share with me on that?
Thanks, Joel. That's a good question.
Well, many people wear boots, and many people have to deal with lots of blisters. And I decided I just wear the shoes that I run in every day in Madison, just my regular running shoes, and some people do that. And I had zero problem with blisters the whole way. And I bought 5 pairs of the shoes that I wear, New Balance running shoes, at Movin' Shoes in Madison before I left, and they mailed them to me when I needed a new pair of shoes. And they lasted about 400 to 500 miles per pair.
Yeah.
And I had no problem with running shoes. Some people wear trail shoes. And the advantage of wearing running shoes over boots, aside from not getting blisters, is that they're much lighter.
Yeah.
And wearing a pair of heavy boots on your feet is like carrying an extra 10, 14 pounds of weight in your pack. So
that makes sense. And this is an interesting aspect of it. You could have things mailed to you, or you could mail things back if you wanted to. There are points along the way, practically every 15 miles or whatever.
Well, maybe a little more than 50 miles, maybe at least every few days, three or four days, you go near a town. And a lot of hikers start with packs that are way too heavy, and they mail a lot of stuff home. And some people have food mailed to them along the way. So, yeah, you can mail stuff home, and you can get stuff mailed to you also.
And the packs, I mean, one guy who was at one of the shops along the way said he had the heaviest pack he ever saw was like 130 pounds or something. But then on the other end, you did write about a guy who had a pack that was like 12 pounds or whatever it was.
Yeah, I met a guy the first morning on the trail, which is one reason I decided to start writing about it, whose pack base weight without food or water was 11 pounds, which was about 9 pounds lighter than mine. And he had a lot of extra light equipment, which I was unaware of when I started, and now it's more common. And so I was interested in what he was carrying. And he was 68, and he was doing it so that he could carry as little weight as possible.
Yeah.
So you can do it with, some people do it with 6 to 8 pounds of base weight without food or water.
Oh. Joel, thanks again. I appreciated the question about footwear, and it made, I tell you what, Carrie, it made a lot of sense to me on the running shoes, a good way to do it. But I can imagine a lot of people thinking, oh, I'm going to need hiking boots, and that can lead to problems if you haven't used them, you know, if you're not used to them, for sure. Dave in Utica, it's your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Very interesting program. Thank you very much. Just a piece of anecdotal information about the growing popularity of the trail. I used to lead groups of high school kids in the Smoky Mountains. And one year I met a woman, this was in the early 2000s, when she graduated college in 1977, 77 people completed the trail. Obviously, that number is much, much higher now. I presume her information is correct. And the other thing I thought I'd add, I did a section hike, and early on, I met a couple with their 9-year-old son. His trail name was Oblivious. And I later learned, and Carrie is aware of all the trail names, I later learned several years later, because I was section hiking the trail, that Oblivious became a triple crowner. In other words, he completed the Appalachian Trail, the Continental Divide, and the Pacific Coast Trail. So there are just all sorts of people out there. It's a wonderful experience. It's not for everyone, but I thought I'd add those two comments.
Oh, Dave, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Carrie, comment?
Well, I'd add about the triple crowners that there are some people that do all three trails in 1 year, which is kind of amazing. The Pacific Crest Trail, which is 2,600 miles long, 2,650, and the Continental Divide Trail, which I think it's more than that. I don't remember the distance, but yeah, doing all. But he's right about the trail not being very popular at the beginning. And in the 70s, 783 people did the whole trail, and 1,438 in the 80s, and 3,346 in the 90s, 79 from 2000 to 2009, and those are the statistics I'm reading from my book, I know the numbers have continued to grow. So.
Well, Dave, again, thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Steve in Madison called in, couldn't stay with us, but wondering if black bears are encountered along the trail, and is there other wildlife hikers have to kind of watch out for?
Black bears are pretty common, and especially in Great Smoky Mountains National Park and Shenandoah National Park and in New Jersey and in much of the trail. So I saw several black bears, and I saw one black bear with a couple cubs, which is a distance from me. And black bears generally are shy, and they generally run if you see them. I saw one when I was in Pennsylvania, and I was it was late in the evening and the rain was coming, and I was hiking along a trail and I saw a bear on the trail several hundred yards in front of me, and I didn't want to stop. So I hiked towards the bear and growled, and it ran away. But and the other big wildlife you see on the trail are moose, in mainly in Maine, and there are plenty of other smaller wildlife such as deer.
But the encounters that one would have, generally, you know, I don't know if there are stories of attacks. I imagine there were probably some at some point. I mean, you need to be careful. If you're sleeping out on the trail, you need to get your food. If you got food with you, it needs to be up in the air.
Yeah, you're supposed to hang your food in a tree or at some shelters. There are 250 shelters along the trail. And in some of those shelters, there's places to hang your food. And there, you know, I've talked to people that had bear encounters, and I wrote about one couple who were hiking in New Jersey with a dog that was not on a leash, and the dog flushed a bear out of the brush, and the bear started chasing the dog, a small dog. It was a blue heeler, and this couple, they're a couple of in their 20s, they started chasing the bear, and then the bear turned on them and bluffed an attack, and the guy had his hiking stick. And he, his hiking pole, and he broke it, so he'd have a spear point to scare the bear or to attack the bear. And then his girlfriend came, and they both to make a bigger front, and the bear bluffed, charged them again. And then the dog came back, and then the bear started chasing the dog again. And so they were mostly worried about their dog, so they thought the dog might go to water. So they ran back along the trail and found their dog near a stream. And I met them the day after this had happened. Uh-oh. And by then they'd taken a little trip in the meantime, but they had bear spray and their dog was on a leash. And that's the most, and I met other people who had, bears had come close to them, but then the bears had left. But I think, I don't know of any, there may have been one bear. There were no bear attacks on the trail or no serious injuries or death when I did it in 2014. But there may have been one since, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, interesting. Eric in Middleton, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how are you guys? Hey, I got talked into doing the Smoky Mountain section hike with my much younger son-in-law. Just this past spring, and I wanted to make two comments. One is, even though I considered myself to be in excellent shape, it was 10 times harder than I thought it would be. The footing was very rocky. At times we felt like we were rock climbing. The elevation, I remember the son-in-law saying, well, don't worry, Pops. It's just the first day coming out of the dam area that's tough. And after that, it's just little ups and downs. Well, that nothing could be further from the truth. It was up and down all 4 days to the point where you got to your shelter and your legs were like gumbo and you collapsed. So I want to tell people, unlike what I consider the horrible movie rendition of the book, A Walk in on the Trail, it's tough. And the second point I wanted to make is that on the bears, this past spring, imagine you've done about 10 miles already. You're exhausted, and you got a permit to sleep at one of their sites. It's just an open air kind of bunk area, and they're closing it. The rangers are closing it because of too much aggressive bear activity. And you're looking at hiking another 2 or 3 miles to find the next one. So it is a great experience. It was gorgeous. But be prepared, be fit, and call ahead and look at the apps, because your sleeping venue could be closed.
Well, what do you think, Carrie?
Well, I think for many people to start the trail, it is difficult at the start, and it takes a while to get used to it. So he just started at the Smokies, and the climb he was describing is a steep climb, and part of the Smokies is difficult. So, but it would be difficult for anybody just starting. But once you get going, the Smokies, by the time I got there, was actually pretty easy. But the most difficult part of the trail is in New Hampshire and Maine, where it actually is very difficult, and you are essentially doing almost rock climbing many times because the trail goes straight up a lot of these mountains. But the Great Smokies is kind of crowded with the shelters because there are many people there because of the national park.
Yeah.
But in most of the trail, especially when I was doing it, behind the big trail bubble, the shelters are not crowded, and it's usually not a problem. But in the Smokies, it would be a problem.
And Jeff Robbins thinks that Eric was talking about the movie was probably a 2015 movie, A Walk in the Woods with Robert Redford. That's probably, I don't know if you saw the movie.
I saw it, and I would agree to him. It was not a very good movie and not a great representation of the trail.
Oh, all right. Eric, you got somebody who agrees with you there. Our guest today is Carrie Siegel, and his book, A Talk in the Woods, Voices Along the Appalachian Trail, and great talking with him today. And you can join in, too, with your own questions or comments. Number to call, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about the Appalachian Trail today with Carrie Siegel. His book is titled A Talk in the Woods, Voices Along the Appalachian Trail. Great to have him with us today. And you join in, give us an email to talk at WPR.org, or you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. I want to talk about some of the other people. People hike the Appalachian Trail for a variety of reasons. Some do it to prove themselves, others that they can overcome difficulties in their lives. And you met one such hiker in Phil Valentine. I think his trail name was Right Click. And an interesting guy, and he was had something to prove to himself. I guess he had been a substance abuser.
Yes, he was. And I'll read you the first paragraph. I lead every story mainly with people that I write about. But he wrote, Phil Right-Click Valentine says he was shaking, this is in quotes, and quaking in withdrawal from heavy narcotic medication, brutal chemotherapy, and intense radiation treatments in late 2010, when God called him through hike the AT. Right-Click says God whispered, walk the Appalachian Trail. Wait, what, the whole thing, Right-Click replied? Mm-hmm, the whole thing, God replied. When he told Sandy, his wife of 21 years, she thought he was delusional and said, okay, honey, whatever you say, you're so sweet. And Right-Click had never done any hiking or backpacking, but he decided that he was going to do it. He said he wanted to show that recovering alcoholics and drug addicts can do things such as this. And at the time, he was the executive director of the Connecticut Community for Addiction Recovery. And he decided that he asked for time off from his job to do the trail. He decided he was going to do it regardless, but they told him he could take a leave to hike it. And he tried to raise $75,000 for his organization hiking it. And he said, I want to leave a legacy that people in recovery from alcohol and other addiction, people in recovery from cancer, we do survive, and we go on to do extraordinary things. And he was named Right Click because when he started it, he weighed 254 pounds, he was carrying a heavy pack, and his knee clicked when he hiked. But when I met him, he weighed 200. And the clicking had stopped, and he was no longer taking drugs for his high blood pressure and high cholesterol.
Yeah.
And so he did finish the trail. And
Interesting guy. Rachel in Racine has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Larry. I love your show.
Thank you.
I want to share the fact that as a child, I lived in Massachusetts, my family knew the founder of the Appalachian Trail, Benton McKay. He was the one that dreamed up the theory of hitching all the trails together and going down the spine of the Appalachians.
Very cool. Carrie, do you familiar?
Yeah, but it's correct that Benton McKay, it was his idea. And the guy primarily responsible for making his idea reality, his name was Myron Avery. And he was a lawyer in Maine, but the Appalachian Trail became his passion. And that's basically what he did on weekends and free time. And he was the guy that basically kind of mapped the whole trail and measured the whole trail. And he was the first guy to hike it, basically by mapping the trail and measuring it. And he did it before the trail opened in 1937. And basically, the trail became his life until he died of a heart attack. I think it was in 1952. But Myron Avery, it was Benton McKay's idea, but Myron Avery was the guy who basically made his idea a reality.
Yeah, very interesting. Rachel, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Skip and Milton, your turn. Hi, Skip.
Well, hi, Larry. Great show. I wish I could have heard the whole thing because I just came on late in it, but... I want to mention my daughter, who was just in her late teens at the time. She did a through hike on the AT in 2009, the wettest season on record for rainfall. At least that's what she was told. And it rained a lot. It rained all the way through Virginia, and that was a challenge. I went out to meet her in the northern part of the hike for just 2 weeks. I was still working then, so I would have liked to hike farther, but anyway, 2 weeks and 171 miles. And it was good weather compared to what she had. We had 2.5 days of snow and only 2 days of rain. So in 2 weeks, that was great weather. She was thrilled. But when I looked at her foot when she were getting ready to climb into the sleeping bags, I noticed her feet looked like Swiss cheese on the bottom. I mean, they were big holes. They were white and big holes. I thought, oh, those are never going to be the same again. But they did heal. It took a while, but her feet just never dried out because it just kept raining and raining and raining. And I hiked the Pacific Crest Trail 50 years ago, and it was in 1976, it was the wettest season, or the wettest August that Seattle had in 40 years, and it rained a lot. We got big storms out of the Gulf of Alaska, and it was cold. It was high 30s and low 40s. It would rain for 4 days and four nights, continuous, and a lot of the cresters going all the way from Mexico were dropping out because it was just
too much,
yeah, so... Yeah, weather can really be a challenge. I just want to end with a great book on the PCT, and your guest has probably read it. It's Grandma Gatewood's Walk, and it was, I believe that's the name of it. She hiked. She was the first woman to through hike the AT, and one of the early ones to have done so, and she did it under extraordinary conditions, including a hurricane.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Skip, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Richard in Two Rivers a chance to join in. Richard, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call.
Yeah, hey, I've done a lot of section hiking, and I'm currently living on the Ice Age Trail, but up here in Two Rivers. I did hike from my Asheville to Tennessee up through the Smokies and met some lifelong friends on the Appalachian Trail. It's just amazing, you know, a place where everybody's kind of united in one cause. And I wanted to let people know that the shelters have these things called shelter mice, and I'm certain that they're on the Ice Age Trail too. But they know that these people stop in groups at these shelters, and if you turn on your little nightlight at night, you'll see hundreds of eyes looking at you. It's amazing. They can clear into, they can get into a backpack in seconds and get to your food, chew through the bag, and contaminate your whole day's supply in under a minute.
Shelter mice. And you write about shelter mice in the book.
Yeah, I do. Mice are common, and but you have to hang your pack just not only to keep them away from bears, but to keep them away from mice. And sometimes they run over your head or run over your body if you're in a shelter, but you kind of get used to it.
Richard, thank you so much for calling. You had trail angels. I did want to have you mention that. So many hikers of the Appalachian Trail are the benefactors of food and lodging and shuttle service and other means of generosity from trail angels. Among the people you talk to who live along the trail, who stands out as a trail angel?
Well, one of my favorites was a woman whose name is Marilyn Cookie Lady Wiley. When I met her, I'm just going to read a few lines from my introduction. But it said, after I arrived at her home near the trail in Massachusetts, iconic trail angel Marilyn Cookie Lady Wiley gave me 3 oatmeal chocolate chip cookies, which is what she gave every hiker who stopped. She told me that she'd been giving cookies to backpackers for about 25 years, and she baked them in batches of 150, then froze them and handed out 1,800 by early August when I met her. And she and her husband, Roy Wiley, who was 84, they also let hikers, her home was just off the trail. So they also let hikers camp for free in their yard, and they had a big blueberry farm, and you could also pick their blueberries, and I pay for my blueberries. But and another guy who I really liked was in Waynesboro, Virginia. The town was about 4.5 miles off the trail, and people from the town would come out and pick hikers up and take them into town. And the guy who started that program picked me up, and he picked me up in his Buick LeSabre. And when I saw him, I asked, "How old are you?" And he was 91. And he was driving back and forth from Waynesboro, picking up hikers and bringing them back. And he had started this program probably 40 years earlier when he saw people coming in and out of Waynesboro to pick up hikers. And another person I really liked was a guy by the name of Ice Cream Man. He was an 87-year-old retired psychiatrist who lived about a quarter mile off the trail in New Hampshire. And he'd put people up in his yard and give them ice cream. And he loved hikers. He loved talking to hikers. And there were a lot of people like that, and those are 3 of my favorites.
Oh, well, I tell you what, the stories of the people that you and we've only touched on just a few. I mean, and I wish we had more time to talk about them. The good thing is they're all available in the book. And so how do people get the book?
Well, it's on Amazon, and it's on pretty much every place you wanted to buy a book, you can get it, and it's also on Kindle.
So, Cary Siegel is the author. Fun talking with him, and his book is titled "A Talk in the Woods," not "A Walk in the Woods." "A Talk in the Woods: Voices Along the Appalachian Trail." It was great fun talking with him today, and great fun having you listening in today. It's always a pleasure to do these shows, and I appreciate him being with us today in person. The shows, they're always a team effort. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod, our technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on Wisconsin Public Radio News.